Here at Wembley Stadium, 50 years ago, England hosted and won its first and only World Cup.
I am very pleased that this country is acting as host for the final phases of the World Cup. I welcome all our visitors and feel sure that we shall be seeing some fine football. It now gives me great pleasure to declare open the 8th World Football Championships.
The 1966 tournament is arguably most famous for England's controversial goal in the final. Did it cross the line? Did it not? There were also the brilliant displays of Portugal's African-born star Eusebio. But there is a key aspect that has been largely overlooked. It was the only World Cup in history to have been boycotted by an entire continent. And that continent was Africa. But the names of the two men who led an ultimately successful fight for fairer representation at football's top table have long been forgotten. I'm Piers Edwards, and on Missing the World Cup on the BBC, I'll be delving into football history and remembering the legacy of these men. Ghana's Ahini Jan and the Ethiopian Tessema Yidnikachu.
Well, it is one of the untold stories in World Cup history that the 16 teams didn't include an African team. And when you use the word boycott, people express surprise because it hasn't been widely told. Nobody thought about Africa. Let's be really brutally frank about this. People did not know anything about what was going on in Africa. It was behind-the-scenes stuff.
In many ways, the story starts here, on the shores of the Atlantic in West Africa, on the sun-kissed streets of the Ghanaian capital, Accra. For in January 1964, FIFA ruled that of the 16 teams going to the World Cup in England, 10 should be from Europe, 5 from the Americas and the Caribbean region, so leaving the continents of Africa, Asia and Australia to fight for just one place. It's hard to imagine now, given the prominent role of African football and the way in which the likes of Cameroon's Roger Miller and even Ghana themselves in 2010 lit up the tournament. But it was very different back then. So in February 1964, just a month after FIFA's ruling, Ghana's director of sports, Ahini Jan, whose office was just hundreds of yards away from where I'm standing, sent FIFA a telegram in which he cried foul.
Registering strong objection to unfair and unreasonable World Cup arrangement for Afro-Asian countries. Stop. 25 Afro-Asian countries struggling through painful, expensive qualifying series for ultimate one finalist representation is pathetic and unsound. Stop. At worst, Africa should have one finalist in the London tournament. Stop. Urgent. Reconsider. Ahini Jan, Executive Member, Africa.
Well, Jan wasn't just Director of Sport in Ghana, he was also one of Africa's earliest members of FIFA's Executive Committee, effectively the board of the governing body. And he was also working in conjunction with Kwame Nkrumah, the man who famously became Ghana's first president after the country achieved independence in 1957. And I've come to Nsawam, an hour's drive north of Accra, to meet Jan's former wife. So here comes the lady, a big smile, traditional dress. Hello, how'd you do?
Fine.
Lovely to meet you.
Thank you. My name is Matodaji. I got married to Ahini Jan in 1959. I was married to him for 30 years before he died.
And I think he died in 1987?
87.
So I hope it's not too personal a question, but what first attracted you to Ahini Jan?
He got attracted to me. And he proposed to me.
Could you give me a little bit of a description of what sort of a man he was?
I would say affable, lovable, kind, very tall, very, very intelligent. He's a very good organizer.
I'm going to show you something that might jog your memory, which is a telegram that your husband sent to FIFA, the world governing football body, in 1964. He was the first person in Africa, as far as I'm aware, who actually made this complaint. Does this sort of remind you of the type of man he was, if you want to read it for a moment?
I may say that he doesn't want to be cheated. For Africans to be cheated, he wants a place for them.
Jose Coffey is in his mid-70s and a priest, but I've not come here to talk to him about religion so much, but because even though he played back in the 1960s, the Ghanaian is still often described as his country's best ever player. One World Cup winner, Gordon Banks, once even compared Jose Coffey to the legendary George Best, but the chances are you've never heard of him. And why so? Well, probably because he never got the chance to display his skills at a World Cup finals. Hello.
Hi. Have a seat. you are welcome.
Thank you. What was your nickname when you used to play?
I had a lot. The one I did like best was One Man Symphony Orchestra.
What were the other ones?
Wizard Dribbler.
Wizard Dribbler?
Yeah. When I get hold onto the ball, it is very difficult to take it away from me.
You guys played against Real Madrid. Were you part of the match that played against Real Madrid?
That was my first international match at the Accra Sports Stadium here. The score was 3-3, and I gave the last pass for our striker, Edouard, to bang in. They were then, in 1960, the European champions.
Yeah, of course they were. How much of a regret is it to you that you never got the chance to show your skills to the entire world through the platform of the World Cup?
But at that time, I got to know about Dr. Kwame Nkrumah and the director of sports of this country, Ohinijan, that if Africa, the whole continent, only one country will be selected, it's a cheat. So they decided that we should forget about the World Cup and concentrate on the Africa Cup of Nations and the Olympic Games, which yielded good fruits for Ghana. We had the Black Stars proper in those days. That is why we could have represented Africa in the World Cup at any given time.
Yeah. Can you remember being disappointed? Can you remember accepting it?
You know, because the decision had already been taken by Ohinijan and Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, and it hurt FIFA for Africa to boycott the World Cup.
Ohinijan, what sort of a man was he?
He was one of the most intelligent administrators I've ever seen.
I just want to hand you a bit of paper. This is, as far as I know, the first bit of paper relating to the boycott, which dates from February 1964, and it's from Ohinijan to FIFA.
This was from Ohinijan?
Yeah.
So if I was telling lies, you could have exposed me. You have now just reminded me that we should have regretted for not playing in the World Cup, but because of the treatment, it was a cheat.
Now, Ghana were by no means certain to qualify for the 1966 World Cup, but they did have every reason to believe that they might have done. They were African champions in 1963, winning the tournament on the very pitch that I'm standing on now, inside the 40,000-seater Accra Sports Stadium. A year later, they got to the quarterfinals of the Olympic Games, and then in 1965, Ghana, the Black Stars, were African champions again, successfully defending their crown. And of course, these were the years when African qualifying for the 1966 World Cup would have taken place had it gone ahead.
Yeah, I am Reverend Kofi Parry. I was a former Black Star player. I was a member of the African Cup team, which won the Cup for twice, 1963 and 1965. If we had been in the World Cup, yeah, that would have been fantastic. Because we went to Tokyo, 1964 Olympic Games. We were 8, and there were 16 teams.
Do you
have any regrets and wish that you had been able to play at the World Cup?
Of course. That one, I don't know any of us who will say he didn't regret it. Because after we have been watching the World Cup, I said, we could have even gone better than some of the teams. We would have gone for final or win. Because we know ourselves. Because we played with their clubs here in Ghana. If we are able to play Real Madrid 3-3, I think you are one of the greatest teams.
Do you believe it was the right decision, even though you're sad about missing out on the World Cup, do you believe it was the right decision that Africa didn't participate in the 1966 World Cup?
This is a big question. Since they, as the leaders of the nation concerning football, and they took that decision, I think I can't actually say it was good or not.
But you must be able to say it was good or not, because I know they took the decision 50 years ago.
To us, we would have gone.
Well, prior to the 1966 World Cup, Africa had only ever sent one team to the World Cup. That was back in 1934, and the team was Egypt, where I'm watching some children play now. Perhaps these children playing on an AstroTurf pitch right in the middle of Cairo will one day make it to the World Cup themselves. Now, in between 34 and 66, there had been numerous attempts in various guises and various qualifying formats to qualify for Africa, but all had ended in failure. So it was no small matter for Africa to boycott the World Cup. However, this was a time when African pride in its decision-making was at an all-time high as decolonization swept through the continent.
We realize that only when this principle of one man, one vote is adopted throughout the length and breadth of the continent of Africa can the misery and oppression which prevail in many parts of this continent come to an end. It is our aim to strive with all our might to bring this about.
And the most striking of all the impressions that I've formed is of the strength of this African national consciousness. The wind of change is blowing through this continent. And whether we like it or not, this growth of national consciousness is a political fact.
If you talk to some of the pioneers, including Dr. Halim of Sudan, he locates the football argument in the broader post-colonial move into independence story. That is, FIFA is quite as important as the United Nations in order to be recognised as a world body.
Ghana's founding father, Kwame Nkrumah, British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, and lastly, Alan Tomlinson, a football historian who's written four books on FIFA. He's currently working on a biography of Stanley Rouse, the Englishman who became FIFA president in 1961. Rouse promptly walked into a political minefield because nearly two-thirds of the 1966 World Cup lineup would be European.
So to the Africans, it all looked a bit like a cosy European and especially English stroke British stitch-up for 1966. One place for the whole of Africa, Asia and Australia was seen as an absurd situation.
Europe had 10 places out of 33 nations then eligible to take part, while Africa, Asia and Australia had just one place, despite having 40-plus nations. That injustice aside, Africa also argued that its standard of football had improved significantly. Its national teams had recently beaten West Germany, Switzerland and Romania, not to mention Ghana's draw with Real Madrid, who had won five European Cups in the preceding decade. Then there was the economic argument. Since all African and Asian teams were amateur, how were they expected to fund the costs of playing one another?
The story from the early 1960s is that these African countries couldn't afford to see each other, never mind you wander all over the world playing other matches. You know, if you're from sub-Saharan Africa, it's not going to be terribly easy to go and play a game in South Korea or Australia with resources available at the time.
Finally, the politics. The qualifying system meant an African team could face South Africa. The apartheid state had been placed by FIFA in an Asian group,
because of the pariah status it held on its own continent. Now, this infuriated the Confederation of African Football, CAF, the first sporting organisation to expel South Africa because of its apartheid policy. But FIFA, its staff in single digits in those days rather than the hundreds of today, had a far more confused approach.
Rouse had just been to South Africa and recommended the South African Confederation, the traditional all-white one, be readmitted to FIFA, and he'd made some not terribly diplomatic statements about the quality of the personnel in the black association.
Well, what did he say?
He said there are people here who are just being destructive, not constructive, who don't share the government's aspirations, the government, of course, being the regime of apartheid, and who are showing themselves as not fit to offer forms of leadership that soccer needs in FIFA at the moment.
Do you think he was being expedient a little bit, you know, just trying to take a little bit of the easy, this is what we'll do this time and this will be next time? Because as I understand it, he said there will be an all-white team in 1966 and there's going to be an all-black team in 1970 World Cup from South Africa, and on that basis that helped him readmit them to FIFA.
That was his incremental view. The first time I ever encountered that solution, I just laughed. I mean, it looked ridiculous when you were looking at it as a solution. He actually believed that could happen.
Going back to the boycott himself and the South Africa issue, his problem there was that he angered the rest of the continent because CAF led the expulsion of South Africa because of its apartheid stance.
Yeah.
And into the mix, you then have the World Cup places. How much fuel do you think that gave to the likes of Tessema and Ahini Jan and their argument?
It gave a lot of fuel because this was a flaw in Rouse's modus operandi. He tended to see things as separate almost, rather than see the whole landscape. So he would see the question of the World Cup as something not necessarily linked to the complaints and the dynamics coming out of South Africa. In terms of the boycott, he said at one point in his correspondence with Dr. Kayser, the General Secretary, that this was something that we can't do anything about. The World Cup Bureau has made its decision in Zurich. That's it. The decision is taken. People had their chance to talk. Let's move on to the next decision.
Despite Africa's litany of complaints, FIFA refused to change its decision. In a letter to Stanley Rouse, FIFA's then Secretary General, Dr. Helmut Kayser, said he felt it would not be a good idea for, in his words, the prestige of FIFA to alter the decision. Even if some of Africa's arguments did, Kayser's words again, appear reasonable. Well, Rouse agreed. So was it any surprise when the Confederation of African Football, following a meeting here in Cairo by the banks of the River Nile in July 1964, issued FIFA with an ultimatum: give Africa a place of its own at the World Cup, otherwise Africa will boycott. Well, 3 months later, when no such offer was forthcoming, Africa carried out its threat.
It was not difficult. In fact, it was a matter of prestige for Africa too. It was the times that most of the continent were fighting for its own independence, and CAF should have the way also to defend the interest and the dignity of Africa.
Fikru Kidane from Ethiopia is an advisor to current CAF president Issa Hayatou. Now 80, Kidane spent 3 decades working alongside Tessema, a CAF founder and Hayatou's predecessor as president. Alongside Ohini Jan, Tessema is the other main protagonist of Africa's World Cup boycott. If Jan had served up the point, it was Tessema who volleyed it home, both verbally and in writing.
He was a football player himself, a coach. He was Secretary General of the Ethiopian Football Federation. He knew the rules. So he was the one who was really running the African Football Confederation. Tessema was not the African delegate who goes to a meeting just like that and come out. No, he studies all the documents before he goes. And he has his arguments point by point. At any meeting, he argues. Well, he was a very intelligent person. He's a sort of a visionary too. He was reading all the time. I have never seen Tessema without a newspaper in his hand or his book. In fact, he created the technical words for football. the Ethiopian language in Amharic. Most of the world didn't have the equivalent in Amharic.
You were an Ethiopian delegate at the London 1966 Congress. Now, obviously, Africa had boycotted that World Cup, but there they all were amongst all the FIFA members. What was the atmosphere like in that room towards the African associations?
Oh, nothing. In fact, we attended the Congress, and in fact, we stayed until the end. That's a man and myself who were traveling by train.
To go and watch all the games?
Oh, yes, yeah. We have seen all of the games.
It's unthinkable today, but in 1965, the sole World Cup qualifying tie for Africa, Asia and Australia featured just North Korea and Australia themselves. A dazzling North Korean side won 9-2 to reach their first finals, a propagandist dream for the communist nation. At the finals, North Korea beat Italy, who were then pelted with tomatoes on their return home. The North Koreans were knocked out in a thriller against Portugal, yet their credible performance may have helped persuade Rouse that the world's less established nations deserved more opportunity. North Korea's destroyer was the top scorer at that World Cup, Eusebio. He came from Mozambique, then a Portuguese colony, as did three others in the team that finished third, Portugal's best ever finish. 2 years after the finals, in 1968, FIFA unanimously voted to give Africa a World Cup place of its own. Asia too got its own place. It was, at last, going to be a truly global World Cup. The boycott had worked.
FIFA met in Casablanca in Morocco to decide that they give one place for Africa in 1970 World Cup, and they were happy. It was a historical thing.
Can you remember the reaction of Tessema?
Yeah, no, but he said that our fight has produced a result. We have to continue.
So you're saying that he started looking ahead to the next challenge?
Sure. Yeah, there was always a challenge for him.
Today, Africa has 5 World Cup places out of the 32 available at the tournament. Briefly, when South Africa became the first African country to host the World Cup in 2010, Africa even had 6 places. But today's tally of 5 represents less than 10% of all Africa's football nations, and that still doesn't compare well to some of its rivals. Europe gets 25%. 45%, meanwhile, of South America's nations are afforded a place. So half a century on from the boycott, is Africa happy with its representation? Well, I've come to the Confederation of African Football headquarters in Western Cairo to ask that question of the Secretary General of CAF, Hisham El Amrani.
We always wish to push for stronger representation. We believe that also not only the level has been tremendously increased across the continent, but also with all the football stars and African football stars playing outside the continent of Africa. And we believe that with the 54 member associations and 32 teams playing the World Cup, we deserve a stronger representation.
Back in 1960, in the 1960s, CAF said they wanted a World Cup which was truly global and free of exclusivity. And in a CAF memo during the time of the FIFA elections, you said you wanted a World Cup that was free of politics. How difficult is it to get that politics out of football?
It's always difficult to separate. But then, of course, each continent in terms of football defends a greater participation. And greater participation means more opportunities, more chances also to deliver better during that World Cup, and therefore more follow-up and allowing also further development.
50 years on, the plea is still the same. More African places at the World Cup and remove the politics, please. That struggle was started by Ahini Jan and Tessema, two men who helped Africa achieve its World Cup goals. Goals that have recently been scored by Didier Drogba, Samuel Eto'o and Yaya Toure, among others. Both Jan and Tessema died in 1987. Today, there is no monument to either man in their respective homelands. Tessema, who later ensured South Africa didn't participate at the 1968 Olympic Games after threatening another African boycott, deserves more, says Fikru Kidane.
He has done a lot, and it's a pity that we don't have the same quality of people in our continent now.
Do you think he's slightly forgotten now?
Sure, which is a pity. We don't have a name of a street for him or a stadium, and he deserved a lot.
The same is true for Ahini Jan, who lived a much changed life from 1966 onwards. Despite his pivotal role in Africa's World Cup boycott and delivering two Nations Cup titles in his six-year spell as Ghana's director of sport, he was thrown out when Nkrumah was toppled in a 1966 coup. Jan then ran a bar and a bakery. For a brief moment a decade ago, he was given some recognition. But as his wife Matilda recalls, the honour was all too brief.
I was once invited to the stadium and the Hall of Fame with his picture there. Later on, the stadium was named after him. And then they scratched off the name. It's very strange. And I don't know who did that. It saddened me. May his soul rest in peace. One day, things may change so that the stadium will be named after him once more.
You've been listening to Missing the World Cup with me, Piers Edwards, on the BBC World Service.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.